2016 in the interest of A.S., State v. A.S. And we have Marcus J. Bergahan of Hurley Burrish Milligan of Madison representing the petitioner A.S. Counsel?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Marcus Bergahan and I represent petitioner A.S. I'd like at the outset to distinguish this case from the prior case we heard by noting the standard of review. The standard of review to be applied in this case is de novo review of whether delinquency petition is legally sufficient based on the facts set forth within the four corners of the petition and the inferences which can be drawn from it. A delinquency petition needs set forth minimal facts that establish probable cause that the crime of disorderly conduct has been committed and that the juvenile charged probably committed it. The charged offense has two elements that are important in this case: that A.S. engaged in abusive or otherwise disorderly conduct, and that A.S.'s conduct under the circumstances as they existed and as they are reported in the delinquency petition tended to cause or provoke a disturbance. The delinquency petition alleges that A.S. was disorderly when, after school at the youth center, when joined by a number of his peers, he made statements and expressions of violent acts against his teachers and others at school who were not present to hear his threats. The petition that A.S.'s friends were listening to his expressions, and when one friend asked him to stop, he did. None of A.S.'s friends subsequently reported that they were disturbed, though it appears that one individual told her mother about the statements, and these statements were later related to police. The petition indicates that none of A.S.'s friends who heard the expressions reacted visibly, and there's no inference that can be drawn from the petition, from the contents of the petition, that A.S.'s conduct threatened the order of the youth center.
Also, just as I may have the facts wrong, but I thought that A.H. or Amy reported, wasn't that one of the people that was there?
It was one of the individuals who was there, and that led to the referral to the police department.
Well, perhaps I misunderstood. You said that no one that was there. Restate that so that...
No one reacted visibly, Your Honor.
But didn't somebody say, stop talking, I'm concerned,
right,
or words to that effect? I think that's what Justice Wilcox is referring to.
And when that expression was made, when he was told to stop, he did. And because he stopped, there was no further disruption or threat of disruption to the order of the youth center.
Doesn't the petition indicate that Megan had to tell him several times to stop making the kinds of statements he was making? There were several different statements or threats made. Didn't Megan indicate that she asked him several times to stop that kind of talk?
She did request that he stop, and when she made that request, he did.
Well, did she make it after two or three threats, or how many before she made the request? Because it was my understanding that she had to ask several times.
In reading the delinquency petition, Your Honor, I read it as it's possible that it's more than once, but it is not fully clear exactly how many times it is that she said it, how many times she requested that he stop.
But the petition does indicate several times, does it not?
Yes, it does.
Okay, so we can't say none reacted visibly.
I would disagree, Your Honor.
Okay.
The reactions that caused the listeners to say stop weren't necessarily throwing up their hands, weren't standing up, weren't physical reactions. The crux of the disorderly conduct statute is to prevent public disorder, is to prevent somebody from saying certain words and causing a physical reaction. We're seeking to prevent any words, any exchange of expressions from growing and becoming a more major crime. And in this case, we are arguing that it is the internal reaction which the Court of Appeals bases its overturning of the trial court's dismissal of the case. The internal reaction, however, is insufficient based on this court's prior decisions. The internal reaction of, I don't agree with that statement, I don't like what he's saying, is legally insufficient for disorderly conduct.
Mr. Bergen, just to set the context of what occurred in this particular situation, did this occur shortly after the shootings at Columbine?
It did, Your Honor. It occurred 6 days after the shooting at Columbine.
And it's my understanding that your client in this case talked about bringing a bomb to school, that he also made specific threats in regard to particular individuals, a teacher, an assistant principal, a police officer, a fellow student. Is that not correct?
That is correct, Your Honor, and let me clarify that a little bit. I believe Your Honor's reference to the bomb threats was in regard to the second count, which was dismissed by the trial court before it even reached on the first
count. When I read the petition, I read it in regard to the first count because it seemed to relate to what was being said on April 26th rather than April 27th. Am I wrong in that regard?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. I think that was part of the confusion that the record before the circuit court showed, is that the parties could not discern from the contents of the delinquency petition whether it happened on the 26th or subsequent thereto, and therefore was part of the second count.
The second count is not on appeal. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
It was not appealed by the state to the Court of Appeals, and obviously is not before us.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Now, both counts were disorderly conduct, right?
That's correct. And concern different situations.
Differences the dates.
Differences the dates and to whom the statements were made. In the case of the first count, it related to statements that were made at the youth center, outside of school, and after school. With respect to the second count, it was statements made in the cafeteria, again to peers. And there, again, it emphasized really what the circuit court found is that it was immature trash talking, that statements were made, responses to those statements indicated not horror or a response which was contrary to the statements, but rather which seemed to heighten the hyperbole of the statement.
Counsel, I just so that we set the stage, you're indicating as far as the bomb threats that we're not dealing with that? Is that basically?
So long as it relates, the best we can understand, to dates after April 26, it is this appeal deals principally with the threats against the teachers, the assistant principal, and the school police liaison officer.
But in the petition for delinquency, it talks about not only bomb threats, but that there were several computer disks which contained information as to how to make bombs. You're saying that is not included in what we're dealing with?
That was not expressed at the DeForest Youth Center. That related to evidence which was allegedly found at the youth's home.
At the youth's home, and then they also did a search of the locker and found a diagram and description. We're not dealing with that either?
No, Your Honor.
We're just dealing with the black letters in the petition. Is that your position?
That's correct, Your Honor. With the expressions that AS made at the youth center, those are the crux of the petition, and those are the crux of the appeal here.
Well, isn't the crux also the reaction of to whom he uttered those words?
It is. Well, it goes hand in hand, Your Honor. And I would say it was the lack of reaction, the lack of physical reaction.
But one of them did say she was scared.
Yes, she had an internal reaction.
What case? You finished, Justice Roberts. What case do you cite? I assumed earlier you were narrowly tailoring your words to fit the Oak Creek versus King case in terms of a visible reaction. That's why you said in your statement of facts there was no visible reaction. You know, is there another case that you cite for that premise, that if it's just a matter of personal discomfort, that does not fulfill the statutory language of cause or provoke a disturbance?
if the court looks at State v. Werstein, which also cites with approval Brown versus Louisiana, those two cases promote the view that the internal reaction of nervousness or being unnerved is insufficient under the charged circumstances to provide the basis, the legal basis for disorderly conduct. In Werstein, it was the protesters entering the induction site, and one of the petition, the complaint indicated that the staff at the center had become unnerved. Similarly, in Brown versus Louisiana, it was a segregated library, and there was a protest which occurred in an attempt, I believe, to desegregate the library, and the librarian there was unnerved. The presence of the people there were permitted and lawful, but their presence could not be the basis to cause an internal reaction.
The facts in Werstein were what? You had these four people coming into a recruiter or army, what was the fact?
It was the enlistment center.
Okay, the enlistment center, and apparently they didn't say anything that was violent, abusive, indecent, profane, boisterous, unreasonably loud, or otherwise disorderly. They just stood there. Is that correct, or am I?
It's correct. They carried no placards, unlike the other cases that this court has dealt with. There was no apparent disruption or attempting to take over the office, but it was the presence which did not disrupt.
And what was the holding in Werstein? I mean, is it that their presence does not constitute the first element of the disorderly conduct, or is it the second element? What was the discussion in Werstein about, do you recall?
I believe it goes to the second element.
Their presence didn't cause or provoke a disturbance other than someone internally being upset or unnerved by it. Huh?
That's correct. And in particular there, it was the circumstances and the manner of the protest or the manner of the expression which did not lead to the legal sufficiency for the disorderly conduct charge.
Can we take into account that the totality of the circumstances and the circumstance being that this occurred, 6 days after Columbine?
I have great problems with that, Your Honor.
Why is that? I mean, if this would not be disturbing to me as anywhere nearly as much if it had occurred before Columbine or a couple years after, but coming 5 days after, when everybody's sensibilities are heightened, not just these two girls, doesn't that make a difference in this case?
It could, Your Honor. My issue with the delinquency petition, however, is what is missing from the delinquency petition. Had the state added one additional sentence and had it spoken to either the girls mentioned in the petition and asked them, were you aware of the Columbine shooting? And based on that, did this statement, did this expression by AS really cause you concern? And was there more than just turmoil and you were almost caused to react to it? If they would have averred that, I think the case would be completely different.
Aren't we allowed to draw that inference that they were probably, because we're dealing with probabilities here, aware of Columbine? Imagine them not being aware of it.
Based on the language of the delinquency petition, I don't know whether that's a logical inference which can be drawn. The Court of Appeals used it, and this was as the informational background, which could have been present. But our problem with that issue is that it requires the circuit court to speculate on what could the juveniles have been thinking, and could the possibility that they had known about Columbine led them to be more sensitive and therefore led to a possible disruption of public order. We don't know that for sure. And with the inclusion of one additional sentence in the delinquency petition, we would have known that, and the court would have been secure in following out the logical inference.
But we measure this objectively, don't we? Not subjectively? So it doesn't really subjectively matter what, in fact, they were experiencing internally, but on the basis of an objective standard about whether this sort of conduct, words and conduct, under the circumstances, including, as argued by the state, the fact that this is a post-Columbine era, that sort of conduct plus speech tends to cause or provoke a disturbance. Not whether it did under these circumstances, not whether these girls actually did have some fear and act on it in a certain way, but whether it is conduct and speech that tends to have that result, objectively speaking rather than subjectively.
I agree with your statement that it should be objective rather than subjective. I do not agree insofar as that it permits the court to say, well, I know about Columbine, and I think the general population would be concerned about it. What concerns me is what's missing from the complaint. What the court is mentioning is that it's this informational background which raises juvenile trash talking to a criminal level. And I don't know, based on the charged circumstances, that the court can draw that conclusion. And I think the secondary problem with the objective versus subjective analysis is that it then may quickly change how we look at other types of speech. If we were to permit this background of post-Columbine or in a more violent society, the cases that we are seeing now in the press, to possibly deeply disturb someone, we are led down the road to where we have protests concerning deeply divisive issues, such as abortion. And does the fact that one sees either a pro-choice or a pro-life expression deeply disturb somebody after the court's decisions and after knowing what happens to some obstetrician gynecologists whose names are posted on the Nuremberg Files website? Is that basis then? And I don't think that is the objective basis we should be looking to. That calls into question the subjectiveness. And in the delinquency petition, ought state what is objective to these, to the people who heard the statements.
So, if you're done, I want to go back to Wersting, because I think you're offering it, as I understand your argument, in support of the premise that to cause or provoke a disturbance means it has to be a visible disturbance. Yet, as I reread Wersting, it appears to me that the court was only focusing on the first element. That's my read. Yours may be different. That the court said the presence of these four people does not constitute that laundry list of violent, indecent, profane, boisterous, abusive, and then they said, is it otherwise disorderly conduct? They set the issue up that way, and the holding was that way. So if the discussion in Wersting is whether or not the presence can constitute or otherwise disorderly conduct, if I'm correct, how can, number one, how can you validly use that holding to interpret the second element of disorderly conduct? And if you cannot, do you have any other authority for your premise that to cause or provoke a disturbance means that it has to be, it can't be an inward disturbance? Okay, so the first question is, I think I disagree with you on your reading of Wersting. I see it only as addressing the first element, that is, does the presence constitute or otherwise disorderly conduct? If that reading is correct, how can you use that to interpret the second?
I think to answer your first question, I would need to reread it and go through a closer reading of it.
Let's say, hypothetically speaking, my reading is correct. If my reading is correct, can you use a reading interpreting or otherwise disorderly conduct, the holding of that, to in support of an argument of how to define cause or provoke a disturbance?
I think we need to look at the policy behind the disorderly conduct statute. And what the statute attempts to do is to prevent conduct from ever happening.
Okay. I don't want to go policy. I want to stay straight with statutory words. Let's assume that Werstein isn't the case. And it may be. Is there another case that stands for the premise that you're advancing?
I think if you look at State v. Givens, there's a section in which the court quotes from the Legislative Judicial Council, and it notes that the disorderly conduct statute is not intended to provide a basis, if I do the exact quote here. It's not intended to imply that all conduct which intends to annoy another is disorderly conduct. And that's Givens at page 784. The annoying, or mentioning annoying, is part of an internal reaction. It is not the physical reaction, but rather the emotional component of listening to challenging expressions. And so I believe that there's a basis for it in Givens if the court is not inclined to look at Werstein for that proposition. To go back to Justice Sykes, I think, or and some of the other justices had raised, well, what happens post-Columbine? Doesn't this change the equation? And I think perhaps I don't want to dismiss out of hand that it doesn't at all. But I think it changes the quantum of information required of the listener. It reduces perhaps the quantum which requires them to react, and not necessarily the court. So I want to emphasize that the listener if the listener knows about Columbine, and if Columbine, a statement which before Columbine hadn't been or hadn't tended to provoke a reaction in them, now does, that would reduce the quantum of information necessary for the delinquency petition to be found valid, to be found legally sufficient. I believe, though, that the delinquency petition ought to state that, and that is what is missing in this case.
Counsel, you had urged when you first got up this morning that we apply a de novo review under the circumstances here. Now, when I start thinking in those terms, I start thinking about the fact that we would utilize the Serafin case, we would use the case of LAT, we would look at the petition to determine whether or not five W's are present. We would look at the reasonable inferences that can be drawn from the facts set forth in the petition to determine whether or not there is an allegation of disorderly conduct. Am I correct in terms of the approach that would be taken?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Now, if we do that, what is wrong with the petition? You've indicated there should have been one more sentence in the petition, but cannot the court, looking at that petition, looking at the facts that are alleged, looking at whether or not the five W's are included, find that there is sufficient information there for an allegation of disorderly conduct without your sentence? I'm having trouble understanding the significance of adding that one sentence.
The one sentence adds the final W. What offense was committed? As the petition stands now, we have the offense of trash talking, of immature expressions, but we do not have an indication that the public order was threatened, or that one of those listening actually reacted to the statement.
And you think that's essential?
I believe that is essential, Your Honor. Absent that, it would essentially undermine the entire requirement for the delinquency petition. And if the court could then fill in the blanks, if it were left to fill in the blanks, well, here's how I believe I would react if confronted with this. It would obviate the need for the delinquency petition or criminal complaints.
Now, is it your position that this conduct does not fall with, I guess your position first is that this conduct just does not fall within 947.01. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
On the grounds that didn't cause a disturbance, tend to cause or provoke an immediate disturbance.
That's correct.
The Legislative Council report under 347.01 tends to indicate that, as Justice Sykes said, it's irrelevant whether it caused a disturbance for the particular person involved, because it says, quote, the question is not whether a particular person was disturbed or annoyed, but whether the conduct was of a kind which tends to disturb or annoy others. The section doesn't protect the hypersensitive from conduct which generally is tolerated by the community at large. Your position is this would have not tended to cause or provoke an immediate disturbance of public order or tend to disturb or annoy others under an objective test.
That's correct, Your Honor.
It's your first position. Is this abusive language or is it otherwise disorderly conduct?
It's charged as both.
That's right. And the Court of Appeals said what? I was just reading that. Well, we can read that. The trial court found it under neither, right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Although predominantly under otherwise disorderly conduct, if I understood this. Now, do you have a free speech issue here?
We may have a free speech issue. However, I don't think the court needs to reach that issue.
Mm-hmm.
It should look primarily, is our argument, at the sufficiency of the evidence. I don't believe that if we were to assume the free speech issue, if we were to address that it is neither a true threat because of the location where it is stated, and it is not advocating any violence. It is merely an expression of hyperbole.
Now, were you here for the prior argument, counsel?
I was, Your Honor.
You heard defense counsel in that case take the position that true threat does not apply when you have a 947.01 disorderly?
I heard that, Your Honor.
Is that your position?
I had never thought of it in terms so broad.
Counsel, don't you argue that? It seems to me in page 20 of your brief and someplace earlier, in fact, I kind of thought that maybe the first case changed because of the brilliance of your brief. You say, page 20, AS, however, is not charged with making a threat against the subject of this speech. Thus, and then I'll give you a chance to get that. It's the middle paragraph on page 20. AS, however, is not charged with making a threat against the subjects of his speech, and I say parenthetically then, is not charged with a direct or specific statute dealing threat to a person, threat to a judge, threat to a witness. Thus, the true threat doctrine does not apply. And earlier in your brief, you also make that point that since this is not a direct or specific threat statute, the true threat analysis does not apply. What's your position?
To answer both Chief Justice Abramson's and your question, the true threat which I'm talking about there is not the global, does it inoculate against 947.01, but rather the facts of this case, I believe, illustrate that because it wasn't a threat against the person who was present, I grant that it was against people who were identifiable and known to the speakers, but those people weren't present. There was no allegation that there were acts in furtherance. There were no, he had visible, at least to the people who made the report, no means to effectuate the threats, and they were in the best position to evaluate whether it was a legitimate threat or not, and how would they react to that. For that reason, I do not believe that the true threat applies.
Well, I guess you've answered. So you're saying basically that a threat to kill one's friends or family members is not a true threat. I mean, that's what he was talking about, and You're just saying that it was not a direct threat against the person who was there.
Correct.
Well, now you're...
Yeah, that's what's confused.
The language is direct threat may be right. One thing. The question is whether it's a true threat under this constitutional doctrine. So you may have had a direct threat here, whatever that means. But the question is whether it fits under true threat. And you view true threat as, quoting from 19 of your brief, unequivocal. This is the same language as cited in the other case, U.S. v. Kellner, unequivocal, unconditional, and specific expression of intention immediately to inflict injury. And you're saying here that this was hyperbole and immature, and that it was not a threat which was about to be realized. Is that your position?
That is correct, Your Honor.
So if the true threat doctrine does apply, then it doesn't fall within it.
That's
therefore,
correct.
Therefore, at least it's protected free speech.
That's correct.
That's your position.
Because of the circumstances and the manner of the speech.
Okay.
Thank you.
Other questions? Well, thank you, counsel, and you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Castle, you're only arguing 2 out of 3 today for the day.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Jeffrey Castle, appearing today on behalf of the state of Wisconsin. This case, like the Douglas D. case we have just discussed, involves threats of violence made by a 13-year-old boy. Though the violence allegedly threatened in this case was on a substantially larger scale. The legal issues in this case are to a great extent the same as those raised in the previous case, a statutory question whether the juvenile's threats may constitute disorderly conduct, and a constitutional question whether those threats are protected by the First Amendment. To avoid sounding entirely like a broken record, I want to focus on some of the differences between this case and the prior case. And the primary difference is the procedural posture of the case. One thing that is different because of the procedural posture is that counsel for both parties, I believe, agree on the standard of review. This question is one of the sufficiency of the delinquency petition. That is a question that this court reviews de novo with no deference to the trial court's or the Court of Appeals determination. And I believe counsel for the defense adequately states the proper test. Do the facts as alleged in the petition, together with all reasonable inferences that can be drawn from that, lead to a reasonable person to conclude that a crime has probably been committed and that the defendant, or in this case, the juvenile, is probably the culpable party? Now, one of the factors or methods that this court has emphasized is that a reviewing court looks at the allegations of the complaint or the juvenile petition in a common sense approach, not a hyper-technical approach. And my concern is that the argument we've heard from AAS's counsel is exactly the type of hyper-technical approach. If only this sentence had been in there, if only there was an allegation that the girls knew about Columbine, if only there was an allegation that they were really upset, not just that she said, "I'm frightened." I think that's the kind of hyper-technical reading to a complaint that this court has said is inappropriate. I would point out, though, just as a factual matter, because there was some discussion about whether it's reasonable to infer that the girls to whom these statements were directed knew about the Columbine shootings. The petition alleges that one of the girls reported that while discussing the Colorado school shootings, AS said that he was going to do something similar. So it would be an impossible inference not to draw that they knew about the Columbine shootings when he said he was going to do something similar, when the complaint in fact says that they do. I think it's important to look at the context in which these statements are made. This occurs 6 days after Columbine. I think it need not have followed Columbine. Columbine, unfortunately, was not the first highly publicized incident of school violence committed by, unfortunately, young boys, adolescent boys, boys as young as 11 or maybe younger in some of these cases. But there had been, in the year or so prior to this, at least half a dozen or more highly publicized accounts of acts of violence committed by adolescent boys in the school. And that is what makes, when we talk about the second element of the offense, makes this conduct that tends to provoke a disturbance under the circumstances as they then existed. AS is alleged to have made these statements referring to the shootings, making specific threats in an atmosphere where his listeners are likely to be highly sensitive, not overly sensitive, not hypersensitive in the disorderly conduct, as the cases use that, but expectedly sensitive, given the context. I believe the Court of Appeals in this case said, you know, had these statements been made 30 years ago, maybe that wouldn't be disorderly conduct. But the court has emphasized in virtually all of its disorderly conduct cases that we are talking about a coalescing of conduct and circumstances. The circumstances here in which AS is alleged to have said, I'm going to do something similar. I'm going to kill everyone at the school. I'm going to take the assistant principal. I am going to order him to lie down on the ground, count to 10, and I'm going to shoot him before he gets to 10. The context, the circumstances in which AS is alleged to have made those statements is one in which, one, the reasonable inference is that the people to whom he was making these statements knew the people he was talking about. Had AS on vacation in California made those same statements, or AS been a California student visiting DeForest, made those statements, maybe that wouldn't have been disorderly conduct under the circumstances he made it. Maybe the listeners wouldn't have known that these people even existed. But under the circumstances in which he made these statements, and coming within a week of Columbine when he says, I'm going to do something similar, I don't think it takes a great leap of the imagination to draw the inference that that would tend to cause a disturbance, that there would be a reaction of concern, alarm, fear, that school officials would need to be involved, social services, the police would need to react. And that's, in fact, what happened here. I think this factual context, the informational background that AS has expressed concern about in his brief, that it was somehow inappropriate for the Court of Appeals to look at this informational background, that there's nothing inappropriate about it because disorderly conduct consists of the coalescing of the conduct with the circumstances.
One of the arguments that we have so many briefs in this brief or in the other one or in the amicus is that you can't let, for lack of a better word, public hysteria at a time control free speech, because that's when you get into trouble. Like, and they give the example of the court, U.S. Supreme Court, authorizing and approving of removing the Japanese Americans of Japanese background, removing them to camps, detention centers. and that what is sometimes viewed today as unlawful restraints and speech relating to the Communist Party because of mass concepts in the country, that those should not regulate speech. And that here that it's applied that this concern, not an unrealistic concern, but a concern over youngsters doing violent acts should not regulate what free speech is. How do you respond to that?
I agree that they're absolutely right, that one cannot let the national climate of concern make it unlawful somehow for someone to propound an unpopular idea. That's not what happened here, though. This delinquency petition was not brought because AS said, boy, I really admire those kids in Colorado, what they did. I think it's just great that they went out and shut up their school and killed their teachers. Boy, I wish someone would do it here.
You don't think that would be disorderly conduct?
No.
Okay. I don't think so.
But that's not what happened here. What happened here is, and I think that gets, by the way, to the other feature that I think distinguishes this case from Douglas' case, is an argument that AS's counsel has tried to make to try to bring in the advocacy of violence line of cases by saying, under the Supreme Court's advocacy line of cases like Brandenburg or Hess or the NAACP versus Claiborne Hardware, under that line of cases, when you advocate violence, there needs to be an imminent lawless reaction. Well, several courts have noted when that similar argument has been made, and we've cited, I believe, Fifth, Eighth, and perhaps Ninth Circuit cases that say that is not an appropriate analogy. We're not talking here about AS trying to encourage his audience to take up arms against the school administration. Excuse me. It is instead a direct threat, a statement, I am going to do this. I am going to shoot the assistant principal. I am going to rape this fellow student.
Now, do you think it's important that in this case it's not a written communication to the person threatened as it was in the prior case, but here it's a communication to several people about a threat to a third person?
In the abstract, that could make a difference. I mean, I gave the example, he made the same statements 1,000 miles away from home. Here he made it under circumstances where one can infer these are all students at the same school, they know each other, that it's something that's likely to get further transmitted back that will have an impact. So, in theory, yes, that he did not communicate it to the people he said he was going to kill, because he apparently was exempting the people who heard him. That could make a difference, but I don't think it makes a difference under the facts of this case.
Counsel, doesn't it have to be tending to cause or provoke a disturbance under the circumstances at the time? That's the way Oak Creek reads, at the time. So it's not like if I tell Justice Babbage something now, and he might tell a couple of other people, and I can anticipate that 3 or 4 days from now, the word may get to some people, and they're going to be upset, or they may even create or provoke a disturbance. I don't think that's good enough under Oak Creek. I think it has to, under circumstances that existed at the time, it has that qualifier in.
I think it certainly did cause a disturbance at the time, but I think,
not in Oak Creek, it didn't. Under circumstances as they then existed, did not tend to cause or provoke a disturbance, and they go on to say.
Right. And I think the circumstances as they then existed were that it was immediately after Columbine, he's talking to fellow students, and he makes the threat saying, I'm going to do something similar, that tends to cause a disturbance. Even if they all reacted with absolute calm, which I don't think you can read the petition to say.
Well, it took them a while. And no one reported it to the authorities, any authority, apparently.
That day.
One of them, yes, one of them reported it to a parent, and it was the parent that then reported it. Is that right?
Well, that's not what the petition says. AS has framed that sequence that way. The Court of Appeals, in a footnote, notes that the petition alleged that one of the juveniles contacted the police.
Now, suppose these juveniles hear all of this and they think, well, this young friend of theirs is subject to hyperbole, is very subject to influence, and has a very active, vivid mind and imagination, but is not an actor. That is, does not act on this. May have even heard prior things, and guy never does anything. He just talks a big game. Would that be subject to the disorderly conduct in this case? Let me tell you why I asked that question, yeah. Mr. Castle. If you have an objective test, then it's irrelevant, which is what I think I heard you say. It's irrelevant whether these other youngsters think he's just talking.
And I was, as I was pausing to think, I was going to bring that up, and yet, while I agree it's an objective test, I would also note that the court has always looked at the actual reaction.
Yeah, that's what bothers me. That's why I'm pushing on that issue.
And I think the reason why is that I think what the actual reaction is still probative of how a reasonable person would react. I think, how objectively it would be interpreted. And for example, in the Elson case, where there was the disturbance by the attorney at the Mendota Hospital, and the court talked about how some of the patients became agitated as a result. And I think that is evidence that it tends to provoke a discussion, a disturbance. So I think evidence of an actual disturbance, while not necessary to prove the case, is nevertheless probative under an objective standard.
Well, what sort of... provoke a breach of the peace.
I think we talked in the last argument about the example of a domestic violence situation, and I'll even use it where there is no physical contact.
Let's stay away from that, because typically you're not talking about pure speech there. You're talking about speech plus conduct in a typical domestic violence DC prosecution. Here we're talking about, I think it's conceded, pure speech. We have no conduct. And the Warnstein case, it seems to me, stands for the proposition that in that context, we look at these things a little bit differently. And if it's speech that tends only to provoke an emotional response, an internally emotional response on the part of the listeners, whether it's a threat directed at them or a threat directed at somebody else or no threat at all, just speech that tends to provoke emotional upset, that that's insufficient. It has to provoke or have a tendency to provoke a breach of the peace before it's prosecutable.
That's not how I read Warnstein. I think Justice Bradley had Warnstein right. The court was focusing on the first element, and all that its discussion was saying It was not saying that fear or the tendency to provoke fear doesn't satisfy the disturbance element. I think what the Wersting court was saying, lawful presence alone is not otherwise disorderly conduct.
What's your answer then to Justice Sykes' question? Are you saying that causing a person to be internally upset is sufficient to speech plus causing a person to be internally upset is sufficient to constitute disorderly conduct?
I think it can if the speech satisfies the first element.
Let me give you, I think are treading on some difficult waters. Current day rap singers. If you've listened to some of the hard rap, and God forbid that you do, people like Eminem that talk about having intercourse with your mother but using different words, talk about killing your parents and in a rap fashion over and over and over again. Now, I don't think it's just because I'm a mother or a parent that I find that violent, abusive, profane, and indecent. And it does cause me a little reaction, as you can see. So, are those singers subject to disorderly conduct charges?
No, because their speech is constitutionally protected.
Because they sing it?
Because it is, in part because, yes, it is because it's part of a
entertainment.
Entertainment.
So you take those singers and you put them in downtown, down the square in Baraboo. And they just happen to be, come to the Wisconsin Dells, they want to see the International Brain Foundation, they come driving along. And I'm sitting here on a bench at the square in Baraboo. And they're kind of sitting next to each other and, you know, humming a few bars, so to speak. And I hear this stuff. Is that disorderly conduct? I'm outraged. I am absolutely outraged by that.
But I think it would be disorderly conduct if someone sitting on the park bench in Baraboo were spewing obscenities.
Well, no, they're doing it. They're not doing it in an unreasonably loud way. They're not doing it in a boisterous way. Let's say they're not singing. Let's say they're talking with one another. They're not even putting it in the rap sort of pound. They're saying those lyrics about having intercourse with your mother and kind of, you know, just talking that way. And I overhear that. Is that disorderly conduct?
I'm not sure. I think if it were directed to passersby, though, it might be. If, while passersby were...
So if they sing the song over the radio, it's protected speech. If they sing the song in the commons or in the square of Baraboo, then it's disorderly conduct. And I'm the only one that hears it, and I'm walking by. Small crowd.
Potentially. I don't have a clear answer for you. I will confess I have not thought about the problem of rap singers on the public square.
Well, of course, it isn't just the problem of rap singers, because that's particularly maybe offensive to me.
Right.
But then you can get into all types of speech. You know, maybe Perry Como isn't liked by someone. Yeah, I don't
want to
say
Justin. I don't like Perry Como.
I left my heart in, you know, 20
minutes. Let me answer. I think the tendency to cause a disturbance in this situation is not, if I can return to what we're talking about here, is a threat in the school context. The tendency to cause a disturbance is not just from the fact that one girl or two girls was upset. It is that it tends under the circumstances to, whether it did in this case or not, tend to be the kind of threat that would have repercussions in the school.
But that's the very thing we had talked about earlier this morning. I mean, we're not just talking about the facts of this case, arguably. We're setting precedent for all the law in this state. And you moments ago were saying if there was some violent, abusive, indecent, profane language, and if it caused an individual to be internally upset, that conceivably could be the subject, under your interpretation, of disorderly conduct charges. All you need is one individual upset.
And Justice Sykes didn't like my return to the domestic situation. But I think it's a perfect example, because if we're looking at the second element, is one person upset, terrorized, threatened, that I think the court will have to be careful if it says that the fear reaction, the terror reaction of a single individual is not enough to meet disorderly conduct. I think it potentially has ramifications in the domestic disorderly conduct situation.
I know, and that this has all sorts of ramifications. Is the outrage reaction of one individual sufficient? You know, I mean, it's the same thing, it seems to me.
I can't find a...
Well, it seems to me if you can argue, neither can I, if you can argue that the fear of one individual is sufficient, then I think the outrage of one individual is sufficient. And, quote the languages of the case, the offense to my sensibilities, and then you're really getting into troubled waters.
Yeah. I mean, we can go back to the original principles of what this statute is designed to protect, and that is not the hypersensitive, but the sense of peace and order of the community, which is made up of individuals.
Which gets you back to the rap music, which may be dangerous territory.
It may be dangerous territory.
That goes back to something I tried to describe in that last oral argument, and I'll try again. If there was no disorderly conduct charge here, but instead the following day, A.S. actually did go to the school and did take a gun and did all of these things, I think these community would be outraged that none of these students reported it, that the school authorities made no attempt to communicate with AS and deal with what appears to be an aggressive, assertive youngster, that law enforcement police are in the schools, and there may have been a police officer assigned to the school as a liaison, did nothing, and then the school is subject to great violence. Everybody was very disturbed. There's no question about that. And there's no question that AS does show tendencies that no one would like to see in a young child or in anyone, and maybe should be dealt with in a variety of ways. No question about that. At least I don't have a question about that. But my question, which is the one I posed before, is, does that disorderly conduct under the statute? And I'm not alleging prosecutorial abuse of discretion, anything like that. We just have a very simple, in quotes, a legal issue. And I think, don't we have to discard our horror at the quote, threats, direct threats. Don't we have to put away our concern that maybe he would have followed through when we just look at the issue, was it disorderly conduct?
Yes, I would agree with that.
Okay.
That our focus is what happened at 5 o'clock at the DeForest Youth Center and whether social services or someone else should be intervening, whether he was actually going to carry out that threat the next day or the next week is not our focus.
The state's position is a threat to identified people by, how old is AS?
13.
13 seems to be a dangerous little age here in two cases. By a 13-year-old in a school setting where the listeners are not, listeners are concerned apparently, but not so concerned to immediately report it. That is disorderly conduct.
That's correct.
Same threats made on a park bench, disorderly conduct.
Well, this was not in school, by the way. This was,
this is at the youth
this
center.
Is at the youth center.
Right,
so.
Okay. So made in school, the youth center doesn't matter to you.
That's correct. It is certainly a fact that the trier of fact could take into account, but certainly not dispositive.
Threat made by an adult on the park bench. Listener isn't concerned.
Is not.
Disorderly con is not concerned, no. Use it as sort of like in the, is it the Watts case with the person who says OBJ goes first?
I'd want to know more about what the person said. If the person
said exactly the same thing as this defendant said.
I think that might be disorderly conduct. Yeah. If assuming it's occurring, for example, in the same community where the... Yeah.
Said this to his brother at the house.
It might also be.
Can he say it to anyone you can think of where... You wouldn't fulfill the requirement of disorderly conduct?
Under the facts as alleged, well, I gave you an example. to strangers 2,000 miles away from home, maybe not disorderly conduct, or he's up in Bayfield, they don't know where he's from. They don't know whether these people he's talking about is real or not.
It seems to me once you give that mile, it's the converse, they're going to take an inch. I mean, because I can back you up all the way from Bayfield, you know.
I think, you know.
And then I can go from one person to three people to, you know, someone who has acute hearing to someone who's, you know, stone deaf. I mean, once you make that leap.
But assuming it's not... is not concerned about the constitutional issue, but we're focusing on... May I finish, Your Honor?
Yes, of course. Go ahead.
But we're focusing on the statutory elements, whether it's satisfied the statutory elements.
To cause or provoke a disturbance. That's what we're focusing on.
And then I think...
So you're saying if they tell someone in Bayfield it doesn't cause or provoke a disturbance, if they tell someone in Reedsburg it might... from Baraboo, it might cause or provoke a disturbance. If you go down to Dodgeville, it might not cause or provoke a disturbance.
That's right.
What kind of willy-nilly law is that?
Well, it is willy-nilly only in the sense that we leave it to triers of fact to determine when there are factual disputes. It's a factual dispute.
But I thought this was an objective standard, whether a reasonable person...
But juries apply objective standards all the time.
And then we review...
But we are in the context of a petition, not of proven facts.
Thank you, Mr. Castle. Mr. Berghahn, you have several minutes.
Thank you. I'd like to return to Justice Bradley, your wrappers on the courthouse steps. Based on the precedent of this court in Elson and Maker and Teske, I don't think it is disorderly conduct. Your internal reaction, as long as it doesn't lead to anything more, is not disorderly. But we need to look at further facts. For example, in Maker, a situation in a bar in which the performance artist was just dressed only in a jockstrap, and his purpose there was to incite the public there was then reporting that the patrons of the bar became more and more incited. That is obviously disorderly conduct. That's an expression plus conduct. Speech.
Is the phrase son of a bitch, are those fighting words?
It depends on the circumstances.
Well, if we're in a public forum and I repeatedly call you a son of a bitch and you don't punch me out, is that not disorderly conduct? In other words, the more civilized and restrained you are, is that just let me go on and on?
It may.
Also,
well, society, it seems to me, is changing, and we sometimes bend over backwards to avoid open conflict, actual fighting. And as we try to do that, you're saying that we're cutting the guts right out of the disorderly conduct statute. Is that right?
I don't mean to avoid your question, but let me address how the delinquency petitioner, the criminal complaint in that case, would read. If you were in a public forum and someone kept addressing you as son of a bitch, I would imagine that the criminal complaint would, or the officer interviewing you would ask you whether this almost provoked you, whether you were going to be caused to react, but for your better education and your polite manner, you did not. In that case, under those facts, it could be disorderly conduct. But the mere calling a person a name or the mere fact of hearing music which roils one internally is insufficient under the case law as it stands. And I hope that answers your question.
You were talking about conduct plus the expression, and I forgot to ask your opposing counsel. This started out with the question I asked about the finding of the map, et cetera, which related back to the statements made on April 26th. That, combined with the totality of the circumstances, do you think that that changes anything here? Finding of the map, the word, if A1 doesn't work, the explosive, you know,
Your Honor, I have other issues with the maps and that we raised in the motions, other motions to dismiss, which weren't decided. So it is difficult for me to separate as the advocate for AS my feelings concerning the maps and the other information, for example, about the mortars. If one accepts as true everything in the delinquency petition, it would be disturbing, and it could lead one to consider that it was disorderly conduct. However, that knowledge was not known to the people who heard his statements. And you're considering more than just his expression at that point. That is how I would answer your question. That is all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Berghahn. Thank you, Mr. Castle. The court will be in recess until 2 p.m., but you are all urged to come back at 1:45, at which point Attorney Joseph...